Welcome to the History of California podcast. I'm your host, Jordan Maddox. Today we have Dr. Tori Olson on the show. Dr. Olson is a historian of the United States since the Civil War, specializing in the U.S. South, popular culture, rural agricultural history, transnational history, the environment, and food. His work emphasizes making history accessible and relevant to diverse audiences through writing and teaching. His most recent book, and the subject of this podcast, is Red Dead's History, a video game and obsession in America's violent past, which uses the video game Red Dead Redemption 2, a favorite of mine, to explore American violence as well as other themes throughout U.S. history. We also discuss his first book, Agrarian Crossings, Reformers and the Remaking of the U.S. and Mexican Countryside, which analyzes rural reform in the 1930s and 40s, as well as other periods of import in the Mexican region. Currently, he is working on a book, The Global Cowboy, How American Country Music Traveled and Transformed the World, which investigates the global rise of country music and its role in promoting rural values throughout the 20th century. His research has been supported by institutions like the National Endowment for the Humanities, and he's published in leading academic journals. At the University of Tennessee, he teaches courses on food and agriculture, video games and history, the U.S. South, and Latin American history. I had a lot of fun talking to Dr. Olson today, both because I love Western history, but also because I really enjoyed playing Red Dead Redemption 2. While I don't often venture into video games, this one was one of those unique experiences that you get in a video game that's both graphically amazing, narratively interesting, and memorable in terms of the characters, setting, plot, and conflict. Please enjoy my conversation with Dr. Olson. Dr. Olson, before we jump into video games in the West, I want to talk about your first book, Agrarian Crossings, Reformers and the Remaking of the U.S. and Mexican Countryside, which essentially challenges the notion that we see borders as impenetrable and national histories as discrete. How did you get interested in this topic?
Yeah, absolutely. First off, thanks, Jordan, for having me on the podcast. It's a pleasure to be here. I am an immigrant myself. I was born and raised in Sweden and moved to the U.S. when I was 8 years old, so very young. I've spent the vast majority of my life in this country at this point. But as an immigrant who's always been interested in American history ever since I moved here, I've always looked at U.S. history from a sort of outsider's perspective and thought very long and hard about the ways that the United States has been a part of the world rather than its own little vacuum sealed unit, given that the United States has been so profoundly impacted by immigration, by foreign capital, by foreign institutions, and then, of course, has shaped much of the world as well, especially in the 20th century, but even before then, in its own sort of conquests and expansions and cultural influence and all that. So I've always been interested in America's place within the world. And this was very opportune because one of the big sort of intellectual trends in the world of academic history has been transnational history, thinking about nations not as the only containers of history. For many generations, the nation state was the sort of assumed unit of history, that this is the natural way to discuss what's happened in the past. And of course, it does make a lot of sense when you're talking about things like Supreme Court decisions and elections, but not everything can be mapped onto the nation state. So I was very interested in getting into this field of transnational history, of thinking beyond the nation state as the only way to make sense of the past, again, fueled by my own background as an immigrant who's lived in these various places. And I got really interested in the place of the American South within that larger world, in part because I went down to graduate school in Georgia. I was living there for 8 years, and then now I live in Tennessee, where I've been for 11 years. So really, the large majority of my life at this point is actually spent in the American South, and I'm like a Swedish Yankee. I lived in Boston beforehand. That's where I grew up in the U.S. So I'm not the most natural sort of scholar of the South. But hey, whatever. We take irony and we flip it on its head, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So and the South was an interesting place to think about transnationally because it's not usually been the target of such conversations, right? I think there's a very well-established culture, both in academia and the wider American world, to think of the South as this kind of sheltered place, as it's disconnected and cut off from the wider world, that it's an inversion of America, it's an inversion of the rest of the world. And that is simply BS. It's really not true. The South has always been a super globally connected place. And I wanted to explore that in my dissertation, right? So this first book, Agrarian Crossings, grew out of my dissertation. And basically in this book, in the simplest sense possible, I wanted to show how the American South during the 20th century was a lot more like the so-called third world than other people might imagine. Because the South is usually placed in conversation with the quote-unquote North. But instead, I was more interested in getting it into conversation with places to the south of it, particularly Latin America and Mexico, to be precise. So a lot of this book is about why the rural South in much of the 20th century actually shares a great deal with rural Mexico in the same time period. And that might make some people's eyebrows go up because we don't think of the South in Latin America as all that connected. Sure, you think about California and Texas and Mexico as being sharing this past. No one thinks about Alabama or North Carolina. I shouldn't say no one, but fewer people. So a lot of the mission with this book was to show, hey, actually, the American South has had a long connection with Mexico and the wider Latin American world, that we should really think of the South as like the northernmost tier of this Caribbean basin, of this larger Latin American Caribbean world. But yeah, I'm thankful to you for reading the book. It's a very academic book. It's aimed primarily at other scholars, and I'm proud of it. But I also don't really want to write another book like that again.
That's understandable. So I'm curious. The border has been in the news, obviously, and sure, if someone were to read your book, trying to come to an understanding of what the border is, what conclusions do you think they would come to just about, not the broader topic of the book, but about that specific concept? What is a border according to your book?
Yeah, I actually think my book has a lot to say implicitly about the immigration crisis that's been going on for the last 30 to 40 years, right? It's really in the 1980s, especially in the 1990s, that undocumented immigration from Mexico becomes a massive issue in the United States. It had existed for many decades before then, but if you look at the numbers of undocumented immigrants from Latin America in the U.S., it's in the 1990s that goes dramatically up on the graph and continues around the turn of the century. So the big argument that I think I would advance as part of this book, and again, it's implicit, it's not totally explicit, is that the United States has had a crucial part in creating the immigration crisis within Mexico. Like that the reason why so many millions of Mexicans, and in part Central Americans, but I will focus on Mexico here precisely, has to do with U.S. engagements and entanglements with Mexico. So a lot of my book has to do with a project that American philanthropic organizations pushed within Mexico, which scholars call the Green Revolution. It's really a project of agricultural modernization, if you will, basically a project beginning in the 1940s of how American scientists tried to teach Mexican farmers how to be more productive and how to grow bigger acreages and yields of corn and wheat and crops like that. And it's a campaign undertaken with good intentions of feeding Mexico, but one that has really disastrous consequences because it's terrible for small-scale peasant farmers. For humble campesinos, country people in Mexico, the Green Revolution really uproots many millions of folks because it advances this very sort of commercial science-heavy fix to agriculture, which most small-scale peasant farmers simply can't take advantage of. They don't have the land, they don't have the money, they don't have the labor, they don't have the capital to pay for chemicals and fertilizer and all these sorts of things. So the Green Revolution really uproots many millions of rural Mexicans and dislocates them. Many of them go to cities like Mexico City, which was once upon a time the world's largest city in the 1980s and 90s, especially when a lot of this is accelerating in the countryside. But when they don't find work in a place like Mexico City or Guadalajara, they often go to the United States. However, because of shifting American immigration law, they can't enter as legal entrants, which they had for many decades previous, and they come as undocumented immigrants. Now, many of these rural Mexicans would have preferred to stay in rural Mexico. It's just that there's no more economic opportunities for them because of the massive transformations of science and business and capitalism that are uprooting a lot of them.
There's another thing I want to pull on here in terms of similarities and differences between peasant farmers or agrarians in different countries. At least intuitively, when thinking about the difference between agrarianism in the United States as it manifested and then peasant farming in Mexico, there's obviously a very distinct difference in terms of how they viewed political goals and outcomes. I'm thinking about this, the revolution. So why do you think the similarities between these two groups have more explanatory power than the differences?
Yeah, so I'm really interested in looking at essentially peasants. That's not a word that's used in the United States, hardly ever. But I'm interested in U.S. Southern sharecroppers and tenant farmers. And they share a great deal with Mexican campesinos in that they usually don't own the land that they work. Mass inequality in land ownership, land tenure, was one of the crucial similarities between a place like Alabama and a place like Michoacán in central Mexico. Now, these peasantries are really different. The one in the United States is mainly biracial in that it's white and black overwhelmingly. And in Mexico, it's largely indigenous or mestizo, and of course, some African descended folks, but significantly fewer in central Mexico. So they have very different cultures, very different traditions. A lot of Mexican peasant farming grows out of indigenous land use systems, which you just don't have that same history in a place like Alabama in the 1930s. And the big difference between how these peasants respond to their exploitation and their landlessness has to do with violence, in the sense that Mexico has a vast, very bloody revolution erupt in 1911. And the United States does not. The United States does see a sort of bottom-up critique of exploitation through the populist movement in the 1880s and 1890s, but it never gets violent. And it's also a lot more reformist than it is radical. There's similarities, but there's, of course, huge differences, too. And just as the 19-teens, a Mexican revolution is much more violent and radical in many ways than the American equivalent, what happens in the 1930s, when both countries have these reformist, left-leaning presidents, Lázaro Cárdenas in Mexico and Franklin Roosevelt in the United States, is that the Mexican variety is, again, one more radical. Because it's connected to this violent revolution, it has much more ambitious goals of land redistribution than anything that happens in the U.S. Though I will say there are moments of real radicalism in the New Deal and how it tries to reshuffle land tenure in the South, particularly through the Farm Security Administration, which is this really ambitious agency that tries to destroy the sharecropping complex and largely fails. But that they tried is pretty stunning.
Yeah. One more string I want to pull on in this book is around the Cold War. I think in the book you dispute that this is the Green Revolution is part of a Cold War agenda, in part because it does take place before the actual inauguration of the Cold War.
Right.
But in some ways, FDR was making a pitch that the United States can take better care of the working class than this emerging communism in the, quote, East. So why do you dispute the idea that this is part of a, this should be, shouldn't be part of a larger Cold War narrative of the United States influencing the global South in a particular direction?
One of the reasons why I think the Green Revolution should not be bound up within this Cold War package is because it has origins that it go so much deeper. And this is really obscured by the fact that the Green Revolution, the phrase, it's only first used in 1968. Now, it had not been created in 1968. Most scholars would agree that 1943, when the Rockefeller Foundation begins its program in Mexico, that is the sort of birth date of the Green Revolution, which, of course, is a pre-Cold War moment. It's several years before the U.S. and Soviet Union are aggressively facing off with one another. But I actually show in my book, in the first book, that it's really around 1903, 1904 that we can see the first roots of a Green Revolution when the Rockefeller Philanthropies undertakes its very first work in agriculture, which is not in Mexico, which is not in the so-called global South or third world, but it was in the American South, in places like Georgia and Mississippi and Alabama, where they tried to undo this massive problem of rural poverty within the South, and again, have ultimately very little impact on changing that, but produce this sort of blueprint for trying to fight poverty that they then return to when they go to Mexico in the 1940s. So a lot of these Rockefeller planners who are in Mexico in the World War II era are actively drawing on the memory of what they did in the South some 30 years earlier, which is really fascinating. And no scholars had really acknowledged that before I wrote my book, which is a fun connection because there's been a lot of research on the Green Revolution, but so much of it has been within a kind of global South framework that didn't really acknowledge the kind of domestic U.S. roots of this campaign.
Last question on this book. We're increasingly in an age of isolationism. This is not only in places like Hungary, but now here in the U.S. What are the kind of broad implications in terms of thinking about bilateralism from this book? Obviously, transnational kind of assumes a bilateralism that exists organically. But are there other lessons that we can draw from this book about the importance of bilateralism and working with our neighbors?
Yeah, isolationism and nativism are at high tide in the United States. Opposition to immigration is at high tide as well. Mexico has borne the brunt of a great deal of this, given that it shares the southern border with the U.S., where, of course, many other non-Mexicans also cross into the United States. I think the most important lesson that folks who are critical of this variety of, let's call it inbound globalization, of people from around the world coming into the United States, need to realize that there's a lot of outbound globalization too, that the U.S. has been going out into other parts of the world and actively transforming them, sometimes for the better, sometimes for the worse, and that the inbound globalization is tied up with the outbound globalization. Think about all of the tens, if not hundreds of thousands of Mexicans who are fleeing the drug war in Mexico to go to the United States. The U.S. is profoundly implicated in the drug war in so many ways. First off, it's obviously U.S. consumers who are bankrolling most of the cartels by buying drugs, right? Whether it's methamphetamine or cocaine or marijuana or whatever. Then it's the U.S. Army that's supplying, the U.S. military that's supplying weapons to the U.S., to the Mexican government in order to fight this war on drugs. They're giving lots of resources to the Mexican government to be able to crack down on these cartels. And then it's usually at American gun shows where the cartels are getting their firepower as well. So there's U.S. money and weapons that are really accelerating the drug war and therefore in part leading to some of the migration that's moving upward. So if Donald Trump wants to build a wall on the southern border, it would only be fair to let that wall not just stop the northbound traffic, but the southbound traffic as well, right? Would this wall keep spring breakers from going to Mexico? Would this wall keep American retirees from moving down to the multitude of expat communities in Mexico? Would this wall keep American companies from setting up assembly shops in the maquiladora zones of the northern states of Mexico? Trump never talks about that. He only talks about the northbound traffic, about migrants moving to Mexico. But I really believe that the southbound traffic of American money, guns, spring breakers, in all these various philanthropic projects, all of that has had big impact on Mexico. And it has spurred some of the migration that's moving people up north. So we have to think about things holistically. There's not just the simple story, Mexico poor, America rich. Of course, immigrants are going to go from one to the other. It's a lot deeper than that. Mexico has been transformed by U.S. actions. And we need to take responsibility for those if we're to understand that northbound traditional traffic that we hear so much about in the news.
We're going to make an incredibly hard right turn to talking about video games now. I have had a long, intimate history with video games myself. I maybe don't portray myself that way. There are certain kind of stereotypes that come with people that play video games that we can dig into later.
Let us remove the stigma. Let us talk openly about this hobby. Because I know the same way. Like when I was in graduate school, when I was an assistant professor, no one knew that I once upon a time loved video games because it was like a taboo. It was something you just didn't talk about. But we secretly were playing, you know, at home, not telling anyone about it.
So can you talk about your rediscovery of video games later in life and what your initial experiences of playing Red Dead Redemption 2, which I have played it all the way through. I've done the online stuff. I'm very familiar with intimate details of this game, but I want to hear your experience.
Yeah, sure thing, right? So before I became a professional historian, I was just a regular kid growing up in America. This is something my students can never understand. Wait, like you were a human once that had like regular pastimes? That's actually true. I did not emerge from the womb doing historiography, to say the least. So I went to high school in Boston in the 1990s. I actually graduated high school in 2000. So a kid of the late 90s, coming of age in that period. And in those years, I was just profoundly obsessed with video games, particularly PC games, because PC gaming was undergoing a real renaissance at that moment, given that many of the franchises that people are still playing today, versions like four or five of, were all coming out then. So, like Grand Theft Auto, Quake, StarCraft, Warcraft,
Did you play
Doom. I mean,
Myst growing up?
I never did. I was not
Oh
all that
no.
intellectual in high
Okay,
school.
okay.
I liked really stupid, action-packed, violent games like Quake. I played so
Yes,
much
yeah.
Quake in high
Quake is
school,
great.
which I'm not proud of, but it was part of who I was. But I was such a my relationship with gaming was so addictive and obsessive in the 1990s that I came to this realization in college, like my very first semester when I started in 2000. Was that I couldn't keep this up and be a good student. Like, I was not going to get a bachelor's degree if I continued playing Quake, especially because I'd just now gotten access to like high-speed internet in the dorms. Like, finally, I was not playing on a 56K modem, which made it a lot more fun. I realized that I couldn't keep this going, in part because I was not a very good high school student. Like, I will confess to you, Jordan, I had a 2.7 GPA in high school, which was a product of me staying up until 2 a.m. playing Quake. So I was like tired the next day. I couldn't focus on chemistry homework. And so I made this momentous decision in 2000 to quit, to get out of the video game world, to swear it off as a juvenile distraction, as something that I grew out of as I was becoming an adult. And indeed, I had a great deal of shame and regret regarding video games. Oh, I could have done so many more interesting things in high school if I wasn't doing this. So I really buried it. Like, I buried it deep in my history, deep in my psyche. None of my college friends, none of my graduate school friends, none of my faculty friends in the early years knew that I loved Diablo, right? They just didn't know this stuff. And in an alternate reality, I could still to this day be swearing that world off and forget that it even existed. But what happened to interrupt that was COVID. 2020, COVID hits. And by that point, I have tenure. I have published Agrarian Crossings. I have stability in my professional career. And I decide in the spring of 2020, this is a really, I'm stuck at home, lockdowns, all the rest. This is a really good time to just dip my toes back in. And it was totally like, the incentive was like, I bet the graphics are amazing nowadays, right? Because I love the graphics. I love the visual element of gaming back in the day. And so I bought a gaming PC in the early pandemic, one of the last machines to be found as they were flying off the shelves, of
I was
course.
going to say that would have been a tough purchase during that time.
I know, seriously. Yeah, I got like a mid-tier gaming PC. And this was purely for fun, right? If I had any feeling that this might impact my professional career, it was for the negative. Right? I was like, this will distract me from my real work, which is writing books about agricultural and agrarian history. And the very first game that I played in the pandemic was not a historical game. It was The Witcher 3, which is this Polish role-playing game, which is just unbelievable. Blew my mind so hard to play this game, which was just so rich in narrative and character building. Yeah, the graphics were amazing, but it was more like the humanistic storytelling in that game really floored me. Like, going from Quake to The Witcher 3 is a pretty vast leap in terms of the potential of video games as a narrative device. And I loved it. Like, I could tell by that point that I was not going to swear video gaming off anymore. And then the second game I picked up, I did so at a recommendation of a friend who said they had very good graphics and that it wasn't stupid. This friend was a fellow historian, a 19th century Civil War era specialist, and the game that he recommended was Red Dead Redemption 2. And of course, I'd known about Rockstar because I'd played the original Grand Theft Auto games back in high school, and I knew how incredibly popular their GTA franchise had become during all those years when I was not gaming. And I think I'd heard just through the sort of word of mouth on the street that Red Dead Redemption 1 and 2 were these incredibly popular and astoundingly detailed, nuanced games. But I picked it up for fun, right? It really was not with the intention that this would become like some sort of career direction that would have been unthinkable in 2020. But in the summer of 2020, I play Red Dead 2 for the first time. And yes, I discovered that it's not stupid. And yes, I discovered that the graphics are unbelievable. But I was more, the biggest epiphany came with that historical content. Because of course, Red Dead Redemption 2 is a historical game. In fact, the best-selling historical game ever made. As Jordan, it's set in 1899 in the West, in the Deep South, in Appalachia, and in the Caribbean. And I wasn't expecting much. As a historian who's literally trained in that exact field, I was expecting cliche, nostalgia, romanticism, a digital John Wayne, if you will. And that is not what that game, what Red Dead Redemption 2 provided. Instead, I got something very different, a game that is really surprisingly thoughtful and nuanced, that showcases a rather diverse cast of characters. Yes, the protagonist, Arthur Morgan, is a straight white man, but a lot of the people that surround him are very different than that. There's lots of female protagonists, female characters, lots of non-white characters, native peoples, African-Americans, Mexican-Americans, immigrants. And the game, while it is indeed very violent, much more violent than anything that ever happened in the U.S., it's not stupid. And playing through the game in the summer of 2020 really made me curious if this game could be used as a teaching tool, given how popular it was and given how thoughtful it often was, not always, but often on certain topics. So I quickly went on the internet and I searched, like, how have historians engaged this game? I searched for Red Dead Redemption in, like, all the big journals that I read, the Western Historical Quarterly, the Journal of Southern History. And I got a whole lot of nothing, because in 2020, very few historians, this game had been out for 2 years at that point. At that moment in time, very few, and by very few, like almost none, historians had even touched on this insanely popular blockbuster of a game. So I came up with a crazy idea of, why don't I try teaching a class that uses the fictional world of the games as a springboard to address the real issues of violence, inequality, capitalism, race, topics that are highlighted in the games, but usually not given much context or explanation. So, yeah, I pitched this to the hires up at the University of Tennessee, and their response was like, what the hell is Red Dead Redemption? They don't know anything about this. And then they also said, do you think students are going to sign up for it? And I thought, yeah,
there's yes,
never
they
been
will.
Anything like this. And it turns out I was correct in that assumption, because the first time I taught this class in fall of 21, the enrollment was just through the roof. It was like twice or thrice the size of a class of this type that I've taught previously on non-video game topics. And it lured in a lot of students who were not history majors, a lot of people from computer science, from business, people who played the game at home just for fun. They decided to come along for the ride as well. So that was the origins of the book that I ended up writing, which was, of course, born out of that first class. And out of this belief that video games can be this powerful vehicle for instilling interest and passion among a wider public about real serious history. I think the game on its own definitely does not teach you the nuances of Western or Southern history, but it, I think, has inspired a lot of gamers to learn more. I think it's planted seeds of curiosity and interest in learning more about the past. And the hope with my book and with the class was to provide, to scratch that itch for people who felt like me, who thought this was interesting games, but what's the real story?
Yeah. I think one of the powerful things about it is the narrative structure, which is also heterogeneous, and you can follow a bunch of different paths. And then the diversity of characters is incredible. I think for me, probably Red Dead Redemption is one of my highlights of my video gaming experience. I think
the first one.
No, the second one, excuse me, Red Dead Redemption 2. I think it still is second to another video game called The Last of Us, which is, if you're looking for another...
I've played it. I've played both of them.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I want to do some table setting before we dig into the specifics in your book. And I want to talk about historiography, something you've already referenced. So charting for people the broad strokes, essentially it goes back to Frederick Jackson Turner, this idea, this frontier mythology where people in the West are portrayed as heroes that are carrying civilization into the frontier. And then in the 70s and 80s, we get maybe more honest scholarship about the violence that existed in the West. And then we move from there to social and economic histories and micro histories. It's been a wide ranging historiography. And I'm curious, because I want to pivot to art for a second. Most people's experience of Western history is through Western movies. Your Clint Eastwoods, your John Waynes, The Searchers. I think my favorite one, now I can't even remember the name. It's the one with Clint Eastwood and he's in this gold mining town and has to dust things up a little bit. And so I'm curious, from your point of view, do you think Western films are following a similar pattern to historiography? And what do you think people took away from this very prominent art form about what the West was?
Yeah, great question. First off, I will confess, I'm not a huge Western movie buff. I have not religiously watched the catalog of classics and contemporary films. I've seen my fair share, but I actually got interested in Western history as a kid growing up in Sweden, reading comic books, particularly a Belgian comic book called Lucky Luke, which was enormously popular and still is across Europe, which was written in the 1950s and 60s and showcases a lot of the same mythology that you're referencing. But yes, I do think that the world of Hollywood Westerns has, in some cases, followed the historians' understanding of this period. For much of the sort of early and mid-century Hollywood films, they're building on very romantic, back-padding narratives of Eastern white men taming, in their words, this sort of savage frontier. And I'd say a lot of this goes back to two, I regret to call one of them a scholar because he really wasn't, but Frederick Jackson Turner, who was a scholar, and then Teddy Roosevelt, who was a sort of amateur historian who wrote several books on the winning of the West. And both of them are very interested in foregrounding white male Anglo perspectives as the sort of the story of the period, which of course captures only a small portion of what's actually going on in this very contested and diverse space. And Roosevelt, even more so than Turner, saw this as a triumph, the winning of the West, that it's a challenge, a contest to be won. And a lot of the Western films of the kind of John Wayne era and earlier were these triumphalist narratives of the white cowboy defeating either his native or Mexican or outlaw adversaries. And it really framed the West as an adventure, like Western history as adventure. In the 1970s and 80s, historians really blow up that framework and begin to frame Western history not as adventure, but either as tragedy or as in a rather negative sense, for good reason. They show, we call it the new Western history of the 1980s, in particular, Patty Limerick, Richard White, William Cronin, among others, who give this very different view of the West, where the federal government is really important, where capitalism is fundamental, corporate capitalism especially, and where you have competing empires throughout Western history, right? This is not just an Anglo space. It's a space where the Mexican, you know, nation and then the Spanish Empire before it are crucial, the French, the Chinese in terms of immigration to the Western coast as well. And I think Hollywood movies soon begin to catch the changing tide. And you have these revisionist Westerns of the 1970s, really, and into the 80s and 90s. I think 90s is when a lot of them come to fruition, culminating, I see, in the HBO show Deadwood of the early 2000s, which is a show that I do love and have watched many a times, which I think really showcases the West as this space of conquest, not just between the federal government and native and local settlers, but the power of organized big business from the East, George Hearst, the mining magnates, the Pinkertons. This is not just a place of free-spirited cowboys. No, the cowboys are wage workers who are downtrodden by these massive corporate structures coming from the East. So I do think that Hollywood, and especially the more sort of thoughtful elements of filmmaking and TV making, have caught up to this. But this is a long-winded answer. Let me say, for Red Dead Redemption 2, which of course grows out of this long tradition, Red Dead Redemption 2 has a bit of both. It's got Frederick Jackson Turner, and it also has the revisionist Western within it. So it contains both, because the basic framing of the game is so Turner that he deserves to be in the credits of the game. It's like
100%.
The West is closing. It's the 1890s, the age of opportunity and possibility is coming to an end. The West is becoming a place of laws. It's becoming a place of order. What will happen to these fish out of water, the Vanderlyn gang, as they navigate that world? Turner, literally like 6 years before the game is set in 1893, makes that exact argument in Chicago at the Columbian World Exposition, this big World's Fair. The same World's Fair that gives birth to Pabst Blue Ribbon and Cracker Jack popcorn, I should note. But Turner makes this big argument that the 1890 marks the perforation line, the turning point when we see an old West giving way to a new West. I mean, he doesn't use those precise terms, but you know, that's what he means. And a lot of people read that into it. And historians have really debunked this theory. 1890 is a terrible turning point. It really doesn't make sense at all. But Red Dead 2 is a lot more than refried Turner. It is also embodies the sort of best of the new Western history in that it showcases how Eastern powers in the game, Leviticus Cornwall, the sort of catch-all robber baron who's plowing through the West with his selfish agenda of corporate greed, how he is really this sort of one, and his forces, and the Pinkertons, of course, his loyal attack dogs, how they are bringing in not just order, law and order, but a very unequal corporate hierarchy to the West. And if the game was just all Turner, I would say, ugh, are we really doing this again? But it's more Patty Limerick than it is Frederick Jackson Turner, as I see it. And I actually wonder whether some of these great legends of Western history know about this game. I haven't read any commentary from them. I'd love to sit down with Richard White and play Red Dead Redemption 2, but the opportunity has not yet presented itself.
One more kind of table setting question. This is, I'm going to call this my Marshall McLuhan question. Canadian philosopher that was famous for this phrase from his
media
book.
Media studies. Yeah.
Media. Yeah. The phrase that the medium is the message. And with Red Dead, you're interacting with the West. And I emphasize interaction because you're a part of it. Versus books that people might read, movies that people might watch. What do you think, is there a difference there in how people will interact with, or how people engage with the concept of the West because it's interactive? Do you see what I'm saying? It feels like there's something substantive there. And I'm curious if you think that there's something that changes in the way people perceive the West by being able to interact with it in a kind of a capacity different than watching a Clint Eastwood movie.
Yeah. I think it certainly sets a much deeper emotional hook to be an active participant in an entertainment product than a passive watcher of a film or a TV series. And not just is it interactive, but it's so much longer. Red Dead Redemption 2, first time I played it, I think it took me 80 hours to beat. That's long. That's longer than the entire run of Deadwood, probably three times over.
You know? Did so you chase down the KKK too?
Of course, it's you have to. Any opportunity to take pot shots at the Klan with no penalty to your honor rating in the game is an opportunity too good to pass up. Yeah, so of course I have a chapter of the book on the Klan and their place in Southern history, which the game kind of screws up and doesn't.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
but yeah, it's a long game, so I think it really inspires a great deal of attachment, which I've found when teaching classes on video games. Like if I taught a class about a movie, we just wouldn't have that much material to work with. But I have some students in my class who've played Red Dead 2 for 1,000 hours. Like, that's a lot of time in the game. And these folks would teach me things about the game that I would never have the time to sink that amount of time into it. So they fill me in on the small details. But so I think that sense, the medium does provide a different engagement with it. And It also makes you, because the game provides you an array of choice in how to navigate it. It's not that complicated. It's basically, are you a good or bad Arthur Morgan? Do you rob innocent people? Do you shoot animals and leave them to rot? You can do that, but you're punished for it via your honor index. It's not, when it comes to video game choice, it's not that intricate in Red Dead 2. In a game like Baldur's Gate 3, there's so much more opportunity for gray within it. But the fact that the game does present you with the choice to make these decisions, you also feel implicated in the morality of these big transformations. You feel as if you have a personal investment in warfare between the U.S. government and native peoples. And that's very powerful, I think, for folks. I don't know, but it also allows players to do horrible things in the game and to capture them on YouTube and put them up and
get, yes, I watched
millions
them.
of views for horrible things they did, which really, there was this big controversy, as you might remember, when the game came out, that some jerk troll player on the internet decided to attack a women's suffragist in the game, and women's suffragists is a key topic addressed within the game, to attack her in some awful way, put it on YouTube and say, oh, look at this, I'm beating up a feminist. And then all sorts of people who don't play video games assumed, wow, Rockstar has made a game about beating up suffragists. And it's absolutely so far from the truth. The game is deeply sympathetic in how it portrays women's rights advocates, but it also lets you do whatever, right? It lets you have that sort of freedom and flexibility to attack or defend whoever you want. So it allows the kind of lowest common denominator to warp the intentions of the game, which can be really nasty. It was a really big scandal for Rockstar. I think an undeserved one, because they had the bravery in many ways to showcase a topic like women's suffrage, which, let's be honest, pretty much never comes up in massive popular video games. So they made a decision to do that, and then they're punished for it. Not really punished. People still love the game, but there's this reputation that, you know, oh, that's the purpose of the game, and it's really not.
Yeah, and I, as morally heinous as it is, I think giving people the option to feed a women suffragist to an alligator, I think that's within their purview. I couldn't even fathom. And when you're talking about choice, I think it's so interesting, that balance between choice and narrative arc, because I think those things can be sometimes zero sum. If you have too many choices, how do you ensure that there's a quality narrative in a story? But I want to dig into Arthur now. Do you think he's an anachronism? Do you think he's a real character that could exist? Obviously, we'll talk in a second about how this game incorporates a large time period, and that there's parts of the game that are prior and after. But do you think, just generally, could Arthur Morgan have existed in 1890, or do you think he's just an extension of the modern mindset?
So Arthur Morgan is this gruff but thoughtful outlaw who's done bad things in his past. He's killed and robbed and things like that, but he's coming to terms with it as he's a little older. I don't know, maybe Arthur's in his late 30s, early 40s in the game. I don't quite know the exact age that he's supposed to be, but he's intricately complex and interesting in so many ways, in part because he is deeply critical and skeptical of ideologies of racial inequality. And this comes out many times in the game when he sees overt racism take place around him. Of course, he's not the target. He's a white man, but he sees his gangmates targeted, or runs into pamphleteers on the street who are selling eugenics literature, or runs into the Klan in the woods. And no matter how you play, Arthur is always going to critique and attack these ideologies around him. So a lot of players have actually, a lot of my students, players have asked me, would that have been possible in the 1890s? Didn't all white people believe in white supremacy at the time? And the answer is, of course, not all white people didn't believe in this. There were lots of critics, right? There were tons of people dissenting toward this. Just consider the Plessy versus Ferguson decision in 1896. There's a dissenter who writes a critical opinion on it. He's from Kentucky. He used to own slaves, right? He's a former slaveholder, which is totally crazy and unpredictable. But yeah, so lots of white Americans, they're not a majority. A majority were invested in racial inequality and white supremacy. But there's definitely a minority within it. So Arthur could have been within that. But here's the sort of anachronism. In the game, Arthur hates politics. Arthur explicitly says, I don't vote. Who would, I can't, I'm really bad at doing Arthur Morgan's voice, but so I probably shouldn't try. Let Roger Clark do that much better than me. Why would anyone vote? That's stupid. A guy who has a fairly radical philosophy, an unusual philosophy of being opposed to ideologies of white supremacy, would have cared about politics. He would have wanted to enact that vision via politics, via voting, or via some other kind of protest movement. My students and I decided that he would have been a populist. He would have been a member of this third party movement, and particularly like the wing that was critiquing racial inequality. And there's not a lot of them, right? It's small. A lot of the populists were just as nasty on race as their opponents. But we imagined Arthur as this guy who cares a lot about politics and would try to act on it as well. So I don't know. The script writers of this game were thoughtful people who did a lot of research. But to totally tear yourself out of the 21st century and place yourself in the world of the late 19th century, I think they did quite an impressive job of it. But given the nature of the product, they're never going to be able to go all the way. And there's certain things that are difficult for Rockstar to talk about openly in their games, like the labor movement, because questions of labor and labor concerns and unionization are, of course, a live wire today. And for a massive corporation like Rockstar to make a game that's actively pro-union, there's internal contradictions within some of this. And I have great respect for the company and what they made, to be certain, but they do stay away, they steer clear of certain types of issues.
There's a number of very fascinating locales throughout the game. I think a lot of people really were invested in exploring the Saint-Denis area, as I was, because it's just such an
That's my favorite
interesting.
place too.
Why do you think that is a lot of people's favorite place? And what do you think the message about the South embedded in how they constructed that landscape? What do they tell us?
Here's a simple answer. I think a lot of people who picked up Red Dead Redemption 2 came because they love Grand Theft Auto. And Grand Theft Auto is all about these big urban sandboxes that you can, play around in. And Red Dead Redemption 2 only has one city, and it's a small part of the map. It is not the majority of the game. Most of the game takes place in rural, or at least very small town spaces. So coming to Saint-Denis, which is supposed to be New Orleans in the game, is a real eye-opening experience because it now suddenly feels like GTA 5. It's not quite as big as Los Santos in GTA 5, but it is quite large nevertheless. And it's an industrial space. It's an urban space, right? Smokestacks and streetcars and electric street lamps. That's what defines life there, not rodeos and cows or locomotives or in that same sort of way. So I find this very interesting because the game was so aggressively promoted as a Western, as this sort of cowboy frontier game. But then huge chunks of it take place in the South, and particularly in the Southern city, which I think was quite paradoxical in many ways. And it was really the Southern portions of this game that inspired me to teach the class and to write the book, because in part, I'm very much a Southern historian at heart. Don't get me wrong, I love Western history and I've read a lot of it, but I did my graduate work in Georgia and I teach in Tennessee. My first book was very much about the South. And the fact that this game portrayed the South in such an interesting way was fascinating because the West has had plenty of time in the cultural spotlight. The South gets less time. There used to be a thriving genre of Southerns with Gone with the Wind and Birth of a Nation, but those didn't fare so well after the Black Rights Movement. Like all that nostalgia about moonlights and magnolia, we had to do away with that for good reason. It was awful. But there hasn't really been a sort of replacement for it. You got like Django Unchained and things like that, but Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? But I can't really call that a genre in the same way that the Western is a genre. So the fact that Red Dead Redemption 2 was bringing tens of millions of gamers, not just to the South in the 1890s, is super interesting because I've always seen the 1890s as one of the very most transformative decades in Southern history. It's when so much shit goes down, to put it bluntly, when so much changes in the South. And I'm happy to talk about that if you want to, but the game doesn't capture all of this, to be sure, but it captures some of it. And the way that it portrays New Orleans, Saint-Denis, is part of that.
Let's pull back here a little bit, and I want to talk about historical accuracy because there is a big question as to why, in some capacity. It is one of those endless projects especially in a game like this where you have so many characters. And I talk to historians all the time that where we talk about, we're very good at replicating the physical architecture of Saint-Denis, or I think,
Rockstar clearly studied photographs of the
yes,
1890s from across the country.
but to capture the mental life of someone living in that space is much more
Much harder.
complicated. And so what do you, is it in some ways futile to pursue this kind of like granular detail of historical accuracy? And so if you were sitting in the boardroom with the makers of Red Dead Redemption 3, and they were asking for your take on how they should think about the concept of historical accuracy in creating a game, what would you say to them?
Yeah, let's hope I get the invitation soon.
I
It
hope
would
it's
be
in
fun. It
production
would
right
be
now.
fun. Yeah, exactly. And whether or not I'm involved, I'm sure I won't be. I'd love to play the game, of course, because they make great games. No matter how good or bad historically they are, they're great video games. So I don't care for the phrase historical accuracy. I find it to be such a narrow way to think about games and how they recreate the past, because accuracy to many video game makers is like, does that gun sound the way it would have in 1942 or something? I don't care how guns sound or even the minutiae of how people are dressed. It's just not that important to me. I'm much more interested in what I will call historical thoughtfulness, how a game engages the sort of cultural and social fabric of the time period. And on that question, I do think Red Dead 2 misses more often than it hits. I think that while they do a great job framing many issues and gesturing toward many issues, there's just too many gaping silences in the game that would have been bizarre by any person who lived in 1899, right? So if you were able to time warp someone who actually lived in 1899 and warped them to our present day, sat them down behind an Xbox and had them play Red Dead Redemption 2, two things would jump out at them the most. If they're like, this is a version of your world, they would say, wait, where's the politics and where's the labor movement? They would also ask, where's religion? Which is really quite absent. There's like a Catholic nun or two, but like religion is of minimal significance, like as far as I remember in the game. But mainly like politics, like no one talks about politics really. Arthur says he doesn't like to vote. There's no mention of Democrats or Republicans or populists. We're having this conversation in November 2024. Can you imagine like politics just disappearing from our world? There not being elections, there not being conversations about issues or candidates. Like the voter turnout now is quite high. It was higher in the 1890s among eligible voters, which is, of course, a much smaller number then than it is today. But people were obsessed with politics. And they were also obsessed with the question of the labor movement, because that was like the social dilemma that was shaking everything up. Whether you were a supporter or a opponent of the labor movement, you had strong views about it. Did you think workers were going to murder you in your bed as an employer, as a big boss at a factory? Or were you dreaming of the 8-hour workday, or dreaming of a revolution, as some workers were? This was like the social dilemma of the day in the West, too. It's not just a New York or Chicago question, it's a Wyoming and California question, too. And that they made a game that has so little to say about these topics is, of course, a shortcoming. So if I were in that boardroom, I would say, hey, y'all, if you're going to set your game in the late 19th century, you have to talk a little bit about these topics. However, the point of my book is not to condemn Rockstar for leaving things out. I think they did a great job given the nature of what they were making. They don't give enough context. That's my job, right? I want to fill in the gaps that they aren't able to fill as this big commercial blockbuster video game. And I want it to be fun. Like, I don't want people who love Red Dead Redemption 2 to read my book and say, oh, I now hate Red Dead Redemption 2, because that is not my
Yeah,
goal, is
well,
to make people
let's lean into that a little
enjoy
bit.
it more.
Let's lean into that, because I, before this conversation, I jumped onto Reddit just to look at, because Reddit's a playground for people that are into video games and all sorts of things. And I was curious some of the conversations about your book, and I found a pretty wide-ranging conversation in just exploring subreddits all over the place. But I'm
Fun.
curious
I
for
haven't even
you.
seen all of this.
I'll happily forward them to you. So I'm curious though, like, what were you hoping? Maybe a video game user that rarely reads a book, what are they going to get out of your book? What's your goal with them? What are you trying to help them achieve by reading this book?
And they really are my primary audience. Like, I was really hoping to reach folks who would never otherwise pick up a book by Richard White or Eric Foner or the kind of the greats of American professional history. What I wanted to show to them is that history is not this dull collection of names, dates, presidents, and wars. You know, like for people who've only taken history in high school and who had maybe not the most inspiring teachers, they get the sense that history is just about memorization. It is about this stale, unchanging body of knowledge that you have to memorize. Or now that we have Wikipedia, you don't need to memorize. You just look it up on your phone. And that is such a narrow way to think about history. So I wanted readers to come away with the conclusion that history is this really living, breathing thing that is just as complex as the crazy times that we live in. The kinds of dilemmas that people faced back in the day were different, but they were similar in the terms that they had so many moving parts, and that we can't understand the moment we live in today if we don't make sense out of the past. I mean, I love this saying that the past is prologue. You might think that 1890s is so impossibly far away. Not really, because in the 1890s, institutionalized segregation is created. Plessy versus Ferguson, 1896. That weighs on the rest of the 20th century. And then movements to overcome that are still around today. Black Lives Matter is like an intimate outgrowth of Plessy versus Ferguson. So if you don't understand how those things go down in the first place, how could you possibly make sense out of the reaction movements and responses and protests and whatnot that are going on today? It's in the late 1800s that corporate capitalism first arises as a coherent thing in America. How do we understand Amazon today if we don't understand Standard Oil or the Central Pacific Railroad? Like those things provide the framework and institutional setup of the big corporations that are dominating not just our economy, but our politics. Elon Musk, like we don't have to look too far to get examples of this. So to me, like I want regular readers to see history as, wow, we need it to understand today, and B, it's exciting. It's dramatic. And wow, is it different from what I learned in high school? That was really what I wanted folks to take away. And I hope that I'm somewhat successful in doing that. And I think the biggest ace up my sleeve in trying to win regular readers over to this is the audiobook of Red Dead's history, which is narrated by Roger Clark, the actor who plays Arthur Morgan. So basically, Arthur becomes your history professor if you listen to the audiobook version of this. And I can still hardly believe that we arranged this and that Roger was so generous to accept our invitation to do this. But he's been a really brilliant ally in this quest, because in addition to being such a great actor, as every gamer knows, he plays Arthur Morgan with just unbelievable and wit. He's a really smart guy, and he's actually narrated lots of audiobooks before. This was not his first rodeo. He's also done lots of history audiobooks too, though I don't think any have lined up as perfectly with his other career as my book. I'm very much hoping that the people come for the Arthur and stay for the serious history. That's my hope, at least.
We're going to close with my favorite section, which is book recommendations. They can either be about the topics we've been talking about or other books that are important or on your mind these days. What are a few books you'd recommend to listeners?
Yeah, so I think fans who really loved Saint-Denis, I have one book for you. It's a recent book. It's a history book. It's not about video games, but it very much is about New Orleans in at the turn of the century moment. And it's The Ballad of Robert Charles by Steve Prince. And The Ballad of Robert Charles explores this very violent episode in 1900 where an outlaw gets in a massive shootout with the police, kills, I think, six or seven police officers, and then gets in a shootout with a crowd of literally 10,000 people. Like, it's a sort of shootout, a firefight of scale way beyond anything even in Red Dead Redemption 2. And it takes place in New Orleans in the summer of 1900. So 1 year, give or take, from when Red Dead Redemption 2 is set. So it sounds like, wow, that sounds super familiar to five missions in Red Dead 2, except there's one huge difference, and that is that this outlaw is a black man, Robert Charles, and his firefight with the police is not because he's robbing a bank. It's because he's resisting arrest for no reason whatsoever. He's being roughed up by the police just because he's black and in the wrong side of town, And he decides to fight back, right? He fires back at the officers, goes on the run. And it's really his protest is a revolt, a violent revolt against Jim Crow segregation as it's coming into place, right? Because in these very same years is when the Jim Crow regime of segregation and disfranchisement is coming into place. And Robert Charles, who's this working class guy, the way that he knows how to resist is with his Winchester. So it's this moment that echoes Red Dead 2, but it's so much more complicated, right? Because it's about race. It's about power. It's about inequality. And Steve Prince's book is just beautiful. It's incredibly readable. It's really nuanced, really thoughtful. It's just about this handful of days, but what they mean to Southern history, to New Orleans history, to African-American history. And Steve Prince, he wrote, he's about my age. He's a historian. He works at Louisiana State University. And he wrote this book having not played Red Dead Redemption 2. But after I read it and after I assigned it in my class, I told him, hey, Steve, you need to play Red Dead 2. So he did. He sat down and played the whole game. And when I was done with it, we got to catch up. And I'm like, how do they do with New Orleans? And obviously, you know, he realizes that they missed the boat on some of this with, you know, things like the Robert Charles. But when it comes to the architecture of the city and the layout and the geography, he had pretty high praise for the game. So he's a fan. He likes Red Dead 2 after writing this book that's so much of that world. So I recommend that one. I'll toss in one other book recommendation too, especially given that this is a History of California podcast and California does matter, which is Richard White's Railroaded, which is about the transcontinental railroads. And California plays a huge part of that story and inspired his book, really is what inspired my railroad chapter in Red Dead's history. It's a long book. It's quite weighty, but it's so rich in detail and the stories that it tells about these real life Leviticus Cornwalls, right? The Jay Goulds and et cetera, is really eye-opening and an enjoyable read as well. So those are two books, one on the West, one on the South, that I think would make for good reading.
Last question. What are you working on next?
I'm interested in California history, believe it or not.
Perfect.
I'm interested in narrating another moment in American history through video games. I'm interested in telling the story of what I call the neoliberal era, the era of deregulatory free trade capitalism, which really Ronald Reagan instigates. He's not the first to dream it up, but he's the one to really institutionalize it in 1980, and which arguably ended on Tuesday, on November of 2024, when Trump's reelection really profoundly rejected the status quo of that neoliberal deregulatory capitalism. So I'm interested in narrating this 50-year span of time through a video game, and that video game is Grand Theft Auto. I am going to be using the GTA games to look at Los Angeles, Miami, and New York over the 1980 to present period and consider questions like income inequality, polarization, mass incarceration, the war on drugs, police brutality, gang warfare, gun culture, automobile culture, the hypercapitalism of the drug trade, the crack epidemic. The list goes on. It's still in progress. It's in its early stages, but I'm very excited to continue the mission of Red Dead's history and use it to understand more recent history. And of course, the GTA games are very different from Red Dead. They're not explicitly historical, except for the Vice City and San Andreas games. And the tone is incredibly different from Red Dead in that it's much more juvenile, much more comedic, much more cynical and dark in its parody. It's much less heartfelt than Red Dead Redemption 2, but even more popular and actually surprisingly thoughtful on certain topics. And even when it's not thoughtful, it gives me opportunity for doing things with it. So that's what I'm cooking on. It's similar in part to Red Dead's history, but moving it into a different era.
I just love that so much. Interacting with popular culture, with academic ideas is what I'm obsessed with and what guides is my intellectual North Star as well. And so I appreciate the work.
Yeah.
Dr. Olson, this has been so much fun. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me.
Thank you, Jordan. Thanks for reading both of my books so carefully and for posing such thoughtful and nuanced questions. This was a lot of fun.
Thanks for listening, everyone. If you enjoyed this podcast, please consider supporting us by either giving us a rating and review or by making a financial contribution at our Patreon page, which is www.patreon.com/historyofcalifornia. We'll see you next time.
Thank you.